Good morning. We're going to go ahead and call it order the Senate Judiciary Committee. We have four bills that we have scheduled for today. What we're going to do is take them out of order because we have senators here who need to give testimony then move forward on their other daily tasks. So we're going to start with Senate Bill 1508. So I'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 1508.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1508 comes to you from Senator Mona Anderson. What the bill does clarifies that a person required to register as a sex offender and to periodically report, if reporting to a city police department, must report to the police department where the person intends to live after discharge from prison in the city or where he is currently living. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you have two amendments in front of you, the dash 2 and the dash 3. Let me do the dash 3. Dash 3 create the task force and sex offender registration. The dash 2 make some clarifying amendments to the bill and also have make an amendment that relates to the affirmative defense. Chair, members of the committee.
All right, thank you. Before we take testimony, we do need to get someone on the phone, I believe. It's
yes.
The police chief of...
Yeah, police chief Ken Johnson from Fairview.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Johnson.
Good morning.
How are you doing today? This is Floyd Przonski. I'm the state senator and the chair of the Judiciary Committee.
Good morning, Chair. I'm very sorry I couldn't be there in person.
I appreciate that. Our first thing, we just want to make sure technically you can hear us and we can hear you. We can hear you fine. Are we coming through okay?
A little louder.
All right, so what we're going to do is we're going to start with the testimony of Senator Mona Anderson, and then from there we'll have your testimony. If you are not able to hear her or if we start cutting out, please let us know so we can try to make adjustments.
Thank you, sir.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Chair Przonski and members of the committee, for allowing me to testify. I'm State Senator Lori Mona Anderson, and I represent Gresham, Troutdale, Wood Village, Fairview, and parts of East Portland. Fairview's Police Chief Ken Johnson, who's on the phone, brought this issue on sex offender registration to my attention. He has, the Fairview Police Department has an unusually high number of sex offenders registering in Fairview. And even more odd is they, most of them do not even live in Fairview. And so, our Oregon law states that, well, requires sex offenders to renew their registration if their address changes, if they change jobs, or begin or quit school. And offenders also must register every year within 10 days of their birthday. The law also requires sex offenders to register within the county that they live. So Fairview has one detective. It's very small, and I think Chief Johnson will explain a little bit more about his department. And they allow a registration every Tuesday morning. But I bring this to you, basically this bill, that so that it would require offenders to register in the city or county that they reside. And I'd like Chief Johnson to describe the problem as he sees it in the city of Fairview, and then after his testimony, I'll describe the amendments.
All right. Chief Johnson, if you'll give us your name for the record, then your testimony, please.
Sure. Good morning again. My name is Ken Johnson. I'm the Chief of Police for the city of Fairview. The city of Fairview is a city with about 9,200 residents. In calendar year 2013, we registered over 258 sex offenders. Of those, 13 lived in the city of Fairview. So it is putting an extreme hardship on our resources to register sex offenders. Almost 95%+ do not live in the city of Fairview. And then I also wanted to share, I think this is just one part of a bigger problem, and I certainly support 1508 and requiring sex offenders to live in the city that they reside. There are certainly other issues that I hope down the road in a bigger session that there's an opportunity to address.
All right. Thank you. I think Senator Mona Anderson has some other remarks she would like to make. Senator?
Yes, thank you. We had a conference call before last week with the police chief from Sandy. We had Portland Police. We had Clackamas County. And so there were a lot of issues about the registration process that probably need streamlined, more efficient, not so many forms, et cetera. So that's why I came up with the Dash 3 amendments. It actually proposes a task force, and they would like to really see changes in the sex offender process. And this task force would just look at alternative methods and models for registration, because it does take an inordinate amount of time and paperwork. The Dash 2 amendments were suggestions from the chair that would tighten up the language. It changes intending to reside to reside, and all registrations, it also changes that all registrations occur in the city or county where they reside, because evidently sometimes when they are discharged, they register with Salem, and then if they're living in Enterprise and something happens in Enterprise but they haven't registered in Enterprise yet, the district attorney has to try them in the county where they are registered, and so it would sort of clean up that piece too.
All right, first let me ask for the panel or the dais, are there any questions for Chief Johnson or for Senator Monis Anderson? Senator Dimbrough.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question, and maybe this is just speculation on your part, but why do you think so many people are registering in Fairview who don't live in Fairview? What would induce them to do that?
We have not directly asked that question for fear of being accused of some kind of discrimination. We speculate that potentially one of the reasons we think 1508 makes sense is because it puts faces with names. It gives us familiarity with the sex offenders that live in our jurisdiction. I'll give you a great example. Yesterday we had an individual here in Fairview registering. He gave his address as somewhere in the area of 82nd and Foster. That's where he hangs out. Couldn't give us any more definitive than that. Current state law does not allow us to require additional verification. Well, how do we verify that address and the resources that it would take? So maybe by not registering in Fairview, he's hoping that face, you know, isn't associated with the name to make it more difficult for us to verify.
Other questions? All right, Chief.
And it isn't just Fairview. The city of Portland, I actually have a graph. The city of Portland has many more that don't live in the city of Portland that registered there. The same with Gresham and I forget what other city that I have on my graph. So it's across the board.
All right. So let me just explain one part that Senator Monis Anderson said that was attributed to some work that I did. When she and I spoke about this bill, I then spoke to legislative council as to issues that have been pending. We've also understand that if you have someone that comes in from like out of state, such as Idaho, but they just move over into one of the eastern cities, such as Enterprise or Joseph, the current statute requires them to travel to Salem to first register, and then they have to go back and re-register. So one of the issues was just the ability to ensure that people who are required to register are going to register, and law enforcement was saying that they felt that this could be such a burden for people to travel 300 miles or 500 miles, whatever it would be, round trip, to actually fulfill that. And so, and it doesn't make, you know, from their perspective and my, I guess, reasoning as well, why would you have someone come in and register in Marion County when their intent is to move basically across the state line to the adjacent county that's in Oregon? So that was one of the reasons we put that there. Chief?
Well, and just so you know, not all, my agency in particular is not equipped with the required fingerprint equipment, which is several thousand dollars. So there are unintended consequences there and unfunded liabilities we would have to consider on the fingerprint and the technology that's required for initial registrations.
All right. So that's part of the issues, and as you can see, the complexity is that that may be best to have this go through a work session to have it continue to be worked on to try to make certain we have everything done. So we do have a couple of amendments here to choose from. Chief, I'm going to let you know we have two other individuals who are scheduled to testify. If you'd like to, if your time permits, you're more than welcome to stay on and listen to their testimony.
I'm actually having a hard time hearing them, and I have another meeting to go to, so with all due respect, I appreciate it. I need to take off, and I strongly support a task force. I'm the immediate past president for the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police. I'm sure that our organization would be very supportive of trying to fix the sex offender registration issues in our state.
All right. Thank you, sir. Have a good day.
Thank you. Take care.
Yeah. All right, so you bet. So the other two people have have written down that they want to give testimonies, Gil Meyer and Ken Noley. Why don't the two of you please come forward? While they're coming forward, if there's anyone else who would intend or would like to give testimony on 1508, please raise your hand so I will know we have others who would like to give testimony. All right, so I'm going to let, does it make a difference as to who goes first? Mr. Noley, it sounds like you've been volunteered.
I have been volunteered. Chair Przanski, Vice Chair Cruz, members of the committee, my name is Ken Noley. I'm a professor at Willamette University, and I work with Oregon Voices, a group of families who have members who are involved in the sex offender registry and the attendant problems. We do research on evidence-based practices and support practices that seem to benefit both the safety of society and the process of reintegrating sex offenders back into productive lives. It seems to us that there are some significant problems with 1508 as it's currently drafted. While I'm very sympathetic to the dilemmas that the sex offender registry places on police departments to supervise and manage the registry, and I can understand the problems that Fairview might be having, I think it's also important to understand that these patterns may be driven by realities that are part built into sex offenders' lives. And that, and are not perhaps driven by nefarious purposes in most cases that are perhaps being speculated upon. We've had very little time to research this, but a few thoughts begin to emerge for us. And I want to maybe contextualize this a little bit to say, what if we were passing a law that required every driver to renew their license in the DMV office nearest their home? We would immediately all be asking the question that Senator Dembro just asked. And I think we need to ask, why are people doing what they're doing here? We haven't had time to do a close look at this, but we know some things. The Portland police only take registrations from sex offenders on Wednesdays from 7:15 to 3 in the afternoon. Thus, any sex offender who has to register has to get to the Portland police office in those hours, no matter what their schedule is. In Troutdale, offenders can register on Wednesdays, too, between 8 and 12. In Gresham, it's Thursdays between 8 and 12. In Fairview, it's Tuesdays between 8 and 12. One of the situations probably is schedules and the placement of where sex offenders' lives take them. Fairview, for example, is served by, but let me back up a little bit. Two of the major problems all sex offenders face are finding a home, finding a job, and managing transportation. All of those are very difficult for most sex offenders. To refer to the particular case that the chief mentioned, when sex offenders give vague addresses for their residence, it's usually because they're homeless. One of the problems we face as a group in Voices is to try to find residences where sex offenders can be settled so that we can track them, but also so they can live reasonable lives. Fairview is located on two bus lines, and it's heavily populated by light industrial, low-wage jobs of exactly the sort that are the only things that most sex offenders can get. Those kind of jobs don't give people hours off. They are, it seems to us very likely that many of these people work in the Troutdale area, or work in the Fairview area, and they're out there, and this is a convenient place for them to register. In any case, we don't know why they're doing it, but there is plenty of reason to speculate that there are basically substantive good reasons for them to do this in good faith. Given the fact that there are roughly 20,000 registered sex offenders living in Oregon, we can speculate, I think, reasonably that perhaps a quarter of those live in Portland. To get that many thousand people through one office on one day, a part of one day a week, seems like a very narrow window indeed. In consequence, it seems to me that maybe 258 people registering in Fairview isn't surprising unless we think that it might be surprisingly low. I strongly support the notion that we try to find out more about why these patterns are there and see if we can come up with a solution that will address all of those problems. I note that there is a work group being set up to work on this, on revisions of this bill. I would ask respectfully that Oregon Voices be able to provide a voice on that committee that comes from the lived realities of sex offenders. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Prozonsky, members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I signed up to testify knowing at the time only about the Dash 2 amendment, and I'm pleased to hear, Chair Prozonsky, that the bill would not be ready to move today. One thing I just need to understand better is that an aspect of the Dash 2 amendment is that it deletes two affirmative defenses that are currently available under registry sex offender crimes, and I don't know why those two affirmative defenses are being removed. It could be technical. It could be inclusive of other fixes, but I just need to know.
We have our certified smart person in the room that we will get that answer momentarily.
Great. I really am excited to see the Dash 3 amendment about the task force. I would like to make two suggestions. I do think it's important that a defense attorney be on that task force. I'd like to see it broadened to include us. I'd also like to suggest that the focus of the task force should be expanded to take a look at the entirety of the registry laws to see if it couldn't be rewritten to be more streamlined. These laws are, in reference to the expungement statute, they've been Frankensteined to death. They're a complicated read. Very often, clients are calling our members, and our members are, like, lost. And so we're talking amongst ourselves. Well, what about this provision over here, but that one over there? It's hard to know where someone has to go to register. You can find yourself with criminal penalties if you make a mistake, even though you've had legal advice. And with the removal of two of the affirmative defenses, we think it's a precarious slope. So we're happy to take a closer look at this.
All right. First, let me ask, are there any questions for the two that have just given testimony? All right. If not, then if y'all would step back and Jessica Minnithy is here from Legislative Council. I think she can maybe answer that question as she's coming up. One of the things is regarding this task force. There is an amendment for that. I've spoken with the sponsor of the bill, Senator Monis Anderson. We may not need to actually do legislation to do the task force, and so it's one of those things that we are talking about whether we actually need to put that into some type of a bill as compared to just doing it during the interim. But go ahead, please.
Senator Prozonsky, Jessica Minnithy, Legislative Council, just here to answer any questions you might have.
All right. Could you explain as to the reasons why the affirmative defenses were taken out?
Sure. Senator Prozonsky, because you are changing the location of where certain people have to register from Marion County to the place of their residence or where the office or school is or where they're released to. There's no reason to have that affirmative defense because the affirmative defense allowed somebody, if for some reason they didn't register in Marion County where they're supposed to, but they did register in their county of residence, that would have been an affirmative defense. Since we're making them now register in the right. county of residence, it didn't really make sense to keep the defense there. So we weren't trying to remove defenses for anyone. It just didn't really make logical sense anymore.
And so in other words, if you actually require them to register, let's say, within the county that they reside, and if they had actually had registered in Marion County, they could use that as a defense to the charge that they had failed to report when they hadn't registered in the county that they moved to?
It's actually just the opposite. So certain people right now have to register in Marion County. It's mainly people who are moving into the state from out of state.
Okay.
But if they registered where they were living, that was an affirmative defense to not registering in Marion County.
Okay.
Because we're making them register where they live, we just removed that defense.
Okay.
If that makes sense.
All right. Any other questions for counsel? Senator Pelosi.
Jessica, just a strange point here. I'm looking at the dash threes, and it says the task force will have 5 members, and it appears to me there are 7 listed. Just a...
Unless I can't count.
Wait, there are, I'm sorry, Senator Close and Representative Brzezinski, you said that there are not 5 people?
Yeah. Well, Section 1 says 5 members to be appointed. Then you've got the superintendent of the state police, 1 member of the Senate, 1 of the House. Governor appoints 2. Okay, he's appointing between the sheriffs and the police. He's choosing, is that correct?
There were supposed to be, I'm sorry, Senator Close and Representative Brzezinski, so it's the superintendent, 1 senator, 1 representative, 1 member of the Sheriff's Association, 1 member of the chiefs of police.
I see. So the governor, he appoints those 2.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Got it. Thank you.
All right. And I think the other clarification, and I have not looked at the amendments in detail, Mr. Noley was concerned, such as in Portland, that you'd have everyone being required who lived in the city of Portland to register in Portland. But I thought that there was going to be, let's say, the discretion that it would be any place within that jurisdiction or county. So I would think that they would have potentially 3 locations, which would be the city, the county, and a state police office.
Senator Brzezinski, that's correct. For most of these, it allows them to register state police, the city department of the city of their residence, or a county sheriff's office. And all 3 of those locations are further modified by the county of the person's residence.
Okay. All right. Any other questions? Thank you very much for coming up. Appreciate it. And I'm just going to ask one more time, is there anyone else who wants to give testimony on 1508? Not seeing anyone. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1508. We're now going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 1517. Bill?
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1517 comes to you from Senator Courtney. It allows a district attorney to seek a sentence of life without the possibility of parole for a person convicted of rape in the first degree, sodomy in the first degree, unlawful sexual penetration in the first degree, if the person was 18 years or older at the time of the offense and the person is classified as presenting a high risk of reoffending, in other words, you're a dangerous sexually offender, which will be adjudicated in a separate proceeding. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's the bill.
Senator Courtney. And while Senator Courtney's coming up, let's see, it looks like we already have 1 volunteer joining him. Is there anyone else who will want to give testimony? That would be 2 volunteers joining the president. All right, is there anyone else who would like to give testimony today on 1517? Mr. President.
Thank you, Honorable Chair of all the Judiciary Committee for Senate. Senator Floyd Brzezinski, the Honorable Senator Betsy Close, the Vice Chair, the Honorable Senator Jeff Cruz, the champion and protector of all mascots, the Honorable Senator Arnie Roman, former Speaker of the House, and the Honorable Senator Michael Denbrough, who is the protector and expert on all restructuring. My name is Peter Courtney. I'm a state senator, District 11, which includes this building, other parts of Salem, Jervis, and Woodburn. I'm joined today by the two women in my life who helped put this bill together, and they have made my life very difficult in doing so. I feel I've already had numerous public hearings on the bill as well as work sessions, and they have not made it easy as I attempted to put this legislation together. One is the Northern High Council, Legislative Council, Jessica Menifee, as well as my legislative assistant, Jennifer Lochner. I'd like to say they're here for moral support, but I know better. But I do think it's a good day for us. Yesterday, I had the privilege to sit in on a swearing-in ceremony that we should all feel very happy about, because the first time, I think, in history, a member of the Legislative Council was elevated to the judiciary for the state of Oregon, Doug Tukey. And I was there, and I almost got emotional about it because my wife taught him in junior high school. It was an amazing moment. But he was also flanked by another individual, Chris Garrett, who was sworn in maybe a day earlier. He was a member of the legislature. So it was a banner day for the legislature and a banner day for the Legislative Council. That is a high honor for someone in the Legislative Council to be so recognized. It's a commentary on the quality of our lawyers that serve as our law firm to help us put this legislation together. I'm just disappointed in Chris Garrett. He held no reception, so there was no cookies, and I let him know about that. He is going to hold a reception. Douglas Tukey, who was legislative counsel, did hold a reception, and so I'm very grateful for the cookies. This bill is 1517, and I really want to thank you, Senator Brzezinski. I did not ask for a public hearing. I thought there's a good chance you would not hear the bill, and I would understand why. And I'm going to make it clear for you, to you, because I understand you've already sent a signal through my chief of staff. I don't expect this bill to be worked this session. I really don't. The magnitude of what I'm going to talk about, because I had the honor and privilege of serving for years on the Judiciary Committee, and you have the most difficult job, because not only can you're held to a higher standard, in my humble opinion, whether you believe it or not, that when you put legislation out, it has to survive constitutional muster. And I'm not saying other committees don't. It's just that a Judiciary Committee, by nature, is held to a very high standard. So this is a very difficult concept I put before you, but I'm very serious about it. And it's all about my little bill. I have long been concerned about predatory sex offenders, and now I am told by learned and high counsel to my right that term is outdated, but I think you know the type of individual I mean when I use that term. This type of criminal has haunted me for years since I served on the Governor's Barbara Roberts Task Force regarding sex abuse criminals. I was the only legislator to serve on that. I volunteered, and I wish I never had. I remember one individual, and I'm not going to go into too much detail. His son had been tortured for days in Portland. He had been hung, and then just before he died, he'd be brought back to life, further mutilated and tortured sexually over a period of days, and eventually he would be killed. His father was on the task force with me, and I could never even bring myself to look at him or even go near him. And I do not understand how he could serve in that task force. And he also was against the death penalty, I might add. But we got into so many of the bills that even today when you're talking sex offender registration, sex offender, they all came from that group, that task force. And I was heavily involved in the writing of all those bills with the help of many others. But I finally told my wife, I will never go back to this again. I cannot take it. I don't want to deal with it anymore, because in writing the bills, we had to get into details of some of the things that were done to the people who were sexually offended by predatory sex offenders. And so I swore off it. So why did I come up with this bill? It all came back to me in August when I read in the Oregonian about a Washington County man named Charles Doc Holloway who was a repeat offender. Way back in 82, he was convicted of raping a 4-year-old child. He was later convicted in 2009 of sexually abusing a 9-year-old child. And late in 2009, the Oregon Supreme Court ruled and reduced his sentence from 25 years to 6 years plus 3 months. He's expected to be released from prison this year. And I'm not going to comment on how I feel about that. Although some psychologists, as Sarah Lochner has informed me, because she's pushed back hard on me in this, believe some of these individuals can be rehabilitated, I want to guarantee that once convicted, these predatory offenders will harm no more. The only way I know to do this, and I'm not a punitive person, I do believe in redemption. I'm not a person just looking to make noise here. It's to restrain them for life. So I introduced this bill. It's my bill. No district attorney, no chief of police, no constituents asked me to do this. There's a person in the audience, when they learned this is your bill, Peter, was stunned. This is my little bill. I did it on my own. I've shown this bill to some prosecutors that's actually looked at me and said, that's interesting. As recently as a few days ago, my DA said, you know, you could be on to something here. They think that a number of cases in which the law like this would prevent further victimization. This bill targets the worst of the worst criminals, rapists and sodomizers. Once found guilty, if the jury also finds that these individuals present a high risk slash or danger to society, the court will assign a sentence of life without parole. This determination will be based on four factors. The defendant must have been 18 or older at the time of the crime, score high risk on the sex offender risk assessment, exhibit characteristics showing a tendency to injure others or to target victims under 12, and present a serious danger to the public. If the jury finds all four of these criteria are met, all four, the defendant will receive a life sentence without parole. I know this sentence seems drastic, but I feel that crimes of this nature call for drastic measures. What happens to children in the hands of these predators is so unspeakable. There's a fate worse than death. Now, it's interesting when I use that phrase, my staff did not like that phrase. They thought it was a cliche. So we searched to where it came from. We thought it came from Shakespeare. It didn't come from Shakespeare. It is a cliche. To the best of our knowledge, it came from Edward Gibbon's A Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, 1781. A fate worse than death, or fate as bad as death. No other state, has a one-strike rule like this. Oregon will be the first. Other states will assign a life sentence with three strikes, sometimes two. I'm concerned that too many individuals will offend repeatedly if given the chance, and I like to work to protect the innocent. I know that as a state, we are trying to reduce our prison population, and no one has worked harder than that than the Honorable Senator Foy Pozanski and Senator Jackie Winters, as well as you. However, reducing sentences for nonviolent offenders is totally different than predatory criminals, sex offenders. In 2012 alone, the Oregon prison system took in 109 criminals for these exact three crimes: first-degree rape, sodomy, and unlawful penetration. I'm told that this policy will not impact prison beds for 20 to 25 years, as that is the average sentence for these crimes today. Thank you, Chair Pozanski, and distinguished members of the High Committee, Judiciary Committee, the Senate, for even hearing this bill. I leave it to you individually and collectively in your wisdom to decide how to proceed with this matter. I will attempt to answer any and all questions. I'm not going to talk about another amendment that I thought was going to be a great amendment. I received a memo from London High Council explaining to me, Peter, it's a great amendment, but then she pushed back. But it was even to add a fifth category that a district attorney would have to overcome in order to get this life sentence. So even as I speak, I'm taking this very seriously. But I understand the magnitude of this bill is such that it really takes a lot of serious thought over a long period of time. I even have the frequently asked most questions, probably, which I won't read to you, but I'm here to either take your criticisms or your comments or your questions. But I am flanked by the author of the bill, as well as my assistant, who worked very hard too. So thank you very much. I mean that, for being willing to even allow me to come here and testify on this measure.
So, is anyone else that's at the table planning to give testimony or just here for either moral support or answering questions that may come from the dais? Questions? I have one question, and I guess it's to counsel. just hearing what the type of sentences would be, I understand for the type of crimes, has it been looked at for proportionality?
Senator Pozanski, I obviously considered that when drafting the bill. That is the bill's greatest weakness, I guess, because you could view the sentences that might be given here and then compare them to other types of crimes that may receive more lenient sentences for what is arguably a more serious crime. That's why it's not just a sentence for a specific crime. There really needs to be something more. It's not a true recidivism statute. The Supreme Court has said that much larger sentences are appropriate for recidivism statute or recidivists if they may not be appropriate for someone who is a first-time offender. However, this is not a recidivism statute. There are some of the criteria that the state would have to prove and the jury would have to find may be looked at as perhaps a substitution for prior convictions, because most likely someone is not going to score very high on a risk assessment if they have no prior sexual offender behavior. And it's very likely that the state wouldn't be able to prove future predatory behavior without some sort of past behavior. But obviously that would be a challenge that would be coming down the road if this were passed.
I have a comment.
Senator Close.
Senator Courtney, I would just like to thank you for bringing this topic forward. It's a very difficult topic, but I think this crime is increasing, and we all read the paper. I think we're all aware that this is a problem and it needs to be discussed, and we need to start looking at our statutes because we have to think about justice for the victim. So thank you for doing this.
Any other questions? Senator Dunbrough.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Senator, I do have a question about the case that stimulated this legislation. The individual's sentence was reduced dramatically by the court. What caused them to do that? Was that due to some sort of technical finding?
Yeah, do you remember the case?
Yes, it was due to basically technicality of the trial, that they medical technicality regarding the evidence.
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Dunbrough, I'm just going to be very careful here. I understand a medical technicality with a trial or something or other such as why they reduced it. I have nothing more than that. I do not know what else. I don't know any of the particulars as why. In fact, you know what? They're going to speak to you because they're going back and forth. This is my team. Would you please speak to the great ones?
I'm sorry, Senator Brzezinski and Senator Dunbrough. It sounds like if it was a medical diagnosis, it might have been that Sutherland case where previously evaluators could testify as a medical diagnosis that somebody has been sexually abused even without physical evidence. That was overturned by the Supreme Court, and a lot of those cases that those diagnoses came into evidence were also overturned and retried. And obviously, if there's a retrial in order to not subject the victim to another trial, oftentimes there's negotiation between the prosecutor and defendant.
One of the things that I may say, the Fifth Amendment, which you didn't ask me about, that I was all excited about, is the possibility of fifth requirement for evaluating defendant psychological evaluation. I thought that would be a wonderful Fifth Amendment. And to learn high counsel before me, as you well know, that's fine. But the defendant would have to volunteer for that evaluation, and no criminal defense attorney probably would dial that, if you know what I'm saying. So that evaluation would be based on the facts that the psychologist had heard in the case, which has no scientific, necessarily, weight, so it would simply be an opinion. So I couldn't get a fifth factor in here that some kind of serious psychological evaluation be done by a psychiatrist and brought it in, and the psychiatrist would have to say this individual is such and such, because the defendant in a trial like this would have to say, okay, I will undergo that kind of evaluation. So probably most of the times I would say, criminal defense would say, you're not going to do that. So I'm just, in case you're wondering, I really thought we could really even go make it even a better bill doing that, and you could, it's just that I don't think many defendants would allow that kind of evaluation to be done themselves when they're facing a life sentence without possibility of parole.
All right.
Thank you, Senator Brzezinski. On that line, could you not approach it from the point that it could be an affirmative defense as the fifth one, so that if they do have the evaluation done and it shows that they are not, then it would be introduced, and if it didn't, if they didn't have an affirmative, they goes forward.
Could you?
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Roblin, I would have to think about that. My first thought is that any sort of compulsion or punishing somebody for exercising their right of or right against self-incrimination would be looked upon askance by the court again, but I would have to think about that a little more.
So I think where you could potentially see that would be where the defense would actually bring it forward for mitigating circumstances to try to debunk the other four or something to put something in front of the jury. But I agree with counsel that if you basically say either you bring this forward or we're going to have a stiffer penalty, then you're getting into the crosshairs of what the of a challenge would probably overturn it.
Also, just you didn't ask the questions, but Chair Brzezinski, if I may, you might want to know why I chose these crimes. These are considered the most serious offenses after murder, according to Measure 11. So that's why these three, happens to be sex offenses, why these three crimes were chosen, plus the issue of the predatory sex offender, it was also combined. That is why you might ask, why these crimes? Because we've heard about proportionality, which, by the way, my staff, which is filled with lawyers, really beat me up on this proportionality. They just went after me on proportionality. You've already heard Learning High Counsel speak to that. Because there would be a constitutional challenge, I'm sure, on this bill if it became law on that very basis.
Let me just throw out another possibility, because since counsel did bring up the recidivism approach, it would seem that if you had, let's say, extremely stiff fixed sentence for the first offense, and then on a second offense, let's say the penalty was 40 years or 50 years, and if it happened then after that, then you could elevate it up to that next level. That would seem something that would probably be more in line with what the courts would be responsive to, based on not having a person subject to something that there's no history, et cetera.
I don't know if you want to respond, Senator Brzezinski, but the Supreme Court has given the legislature wide leeway with recidivist statutes, so that would be a way to make it stronger against constitutional challenge.
Okay.
Can I just ask one more question?
Yes, you may.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, Senator, the example that you gave, that, you know, horrible example when you were, you know, first involved in thinking about these issues, that is, you know, the level of crime, I assume, that you're thinking of that would be applicable here. But can you imagine, could you imagine that is there a risk that a lower level of crime, I mean, these are all horrible crimes, there's no doubt about it, but the one that you gave us an example of was pretty extreme. Is there a possibility that this could be misused and applied to something where, you know, a lower level would be more appropriate?
A life sentence, that possibility of parole, you mean?
Yeah. I mean, something more along the lines of what the chair was mentioning, a serious penalty, but not that extreme of, you know, lock them up for life.
Okay. Chair Brzezinski, Senator, maybe because I'm so old, I remember carrying a bill before any of you were born on the House floor, a Depo-Provera, a drug or some kind that we were doing, I forget what we called it, it was going to be used to treat predatory sex offenders. And I'm not kidding, I mean, it was going to go inside their mind or whatever causes people to do this, you know what I mean? It was good faith. It's, look, all I know is what I know, and you all know much more than I know. I'm not the smartest kid in the class, never have been. I got an inferiority complex, not that we need to go into Peter. I already told you, there's psychologists that are convinced that you maybe can treat these people. This individual commits a crime in 82, he rapes a 4-year-old girl. He comes back, and he goes after a 9-year-old in 2009. My point is, I don't understand what's going on here in terms of the human beings. Do you understand what I'm saying to you? And the only way I know to make sure he doesn't do it, she doesn't do it, it's basically men, in 2009, is you can't physically do it. Do you understand what I'm saying? That's the only reason I introduced the bill. It is a desperate attempt Because what I will tell you, you know this, you all know this, these individuals are incredibly charming and gifted at grooming their victims. And by the time you usually get them, they have done a lot of damage to a lot of other children. They really, really have. I'm not making sensational comments here. Bring in the law enforcement. They have touched a lot of lives. And they have a way of controlling the victims so they never report. And so, no, I short of getting so old your body doesn't work anymore, I don't know how else you do this. That's why I came up with the extreme sentence. I mean, don't get me wrong, Senator Embrough. That's why I did this. I know it's testing you because we don't give life sentences to people first time around unless it's murder. That's a concept we just don't do. And this flies in the face of that. This would be the first time. But if these people are as dangerous and do the things they do to the children, I don't know how else you protect, I don't know how else you do it unless you can come breakthroughs with medical science, and I mean that, and treatment that you're well, if you give this treatment, we can get inside and control whatever that's driving them to do this. So I don't know how else to answer that question. It's a wonderful question. It's an extraordinarily hard question. I'm not trying to play God. I don't know what else to do.
All right, so, Mr. President, I didn't realize, or did you actually introduce that before the Schrader era on dealing with basically sterilization?
All I know is 81 when I carried the bill. Okay. That's when I carried the bill, and right. It was something else.
I do remember
the chemical.
The chemical.
That was me and Kurt did that.
Yeah, I know, yeah, Schrader. Okay.
They came in later. I was doing things. We had some other things going on even before these two were born, Schrader and Schrader. It really was. We were really trying to fix these people. Fix them.
All right, well, thank you very much for coming
thank
forward,
you for
and it sounds
talk
like we'll be
you.
Working
Appreciate
on this in the future. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and close thank the public hearing on Senate Bill 1517, and at this point, we're going to have a public hearing on Senate Bill 1536. Bill?
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1536 comes to you from our Judicial Department, and what the bill is clarifies the statute. It defines public defense provider and clarifies which of the juvenile court records they are allowed to see, clarifies the term record of the case and supplement with confidential file, including documents file. Part of the effective date of the Senate Bill 622, you may remember that from the 2013 session. This is a cleanup, but you also have a two amendments that are in front of you, or will be in front of you. And they address some issues as it relates to adoption and who can see the records and files of the adoptions that took place prior to January 1 of 2014. And it goes to what the person who, when they become 18, what records they have an access to see and what information they do not.
Okay. So what I'm going to do, Wendy Johnson's also here to give testimony. Why don't you also join us at the table? And I'm not sure, Lisa or Pamela, who's going to start off? Okay.
Thank you, Chair Przanski, Vice Chair Cruz, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Pamela Abernethy, a former Marion County Circuit Court judge for 18 years, 8 of those served on our juvenile court, and I currently serve as judge in residence for the Juvenile Court Improvement Program for the Judicial Branch. We're here to talk about Senate Bill 1536. I'm just going to give you the 50,000-foot view. It's a lot. It looks a lot longer and more it is less complex than the length of the bill. So I just want to give you the overview of the five things that this does from the perspective of the Judicial Department. And we're not here to talk about the -2 amendment. I'm here with Lisa Norris Lampe, who is staff counsel to the Supreme Court, and we're both here to answer questions after the overview. So this is a basic, fairly easy fix to some things that happened with respect to 622, which was an Oregon Law Commission bill, and it also clarifies the court's authority to grant access in two new respects. And the bill will allow the trial courts to manage records more efficiently and improve consistency among trial courts with respect to the important issue of access to juvenile court records. We worked with the Oregon Law Commission and stakeholders on these amendments since we had worked with them on 622. So the five main points I want to make are these. One of the in Section 8, you'll see one of the main reasons for this fix. 622 inadvertently created two sets of rules for the inspection and copying of juvenile court records. One set of rules would apply to cases before the effective date of the bill and the other two cases filed after, and that would be difficult for court staff and also for OIA and county juvenile departments who also have authority under 622 to disclose records. So this makes it clear that the new rules with respect to access apply to all cases, but this also clarifies that with respect to the new obligation to have the court keep both a record of the case and a supplemental confidential file, that only applies prospectively. So that's the first point. The second, in sections 4 and 5, these are provisions. By the way, 3 duplicates 2 and 5 duplicates 4, so that's why it's longer than the content suggests. So sections 4 and 5 give express authority to the court upon a finding of good cause to provide copies of audio and video proceedings to attorneys, CASAs, DHS, OIA, and allow the court to impose conditions on that access, such as an obligation to keep it confidential or to destroy. And courts all over the state routinely have been, I think, giving out, at least in my county, we gave out copies of the record, and this clarifies that we have authority to do that and can impose restrictions on how that's used. Then sections 2 and 3 also address giving county or statewide access to OPDS, other attorneys, DAs. And this is important, especially for OPDS, for enabling lawyers to cover for each other, enabling them to look at the whole docket, and also to do conflict checks. So that's a new provision. And then in sections 2 and 3, the Chief Justice, the Chief Judge of the Court of Appeals, or any presiding judge of a circuit court can grant access to researchers and evaluators with restrictions imposed on use of that data. And then section 7 addresses the effective date of the any other person provision. As I said, in section 3 and 5, there is a specific addition for the court to grant access to any other person the court allows. And this extends the effective date of that to September 30th of 2015, which postdates sine die and sign-in dates for the 2015 session. And the reason for that extension is that there's pending litigation with respect to the access by people who are not on the 622 list to juvenile court records. And because of that, people that needed to weigh in on statewide standards for any other person type access were conflicted from having that discussion. So we still need to have that discussion and need the extension to let the litigation work its way through and then have the discussion at that time. So that's the high-level overview. Those are the five things that the judicial branch needs and wants clarified with respect to 622. And as I said, the two new access provisions statewide for attorneys and others, and researchers and evaluators to have access. Those are the things that are important to us. And as I said, Lisa Northlampy's here to answer questions, as am I. And first, I guess we'll get to Wendy's amendment.
Yeah, I think we'll do that. That way, we can open up the panel for everything. So, Wendy.
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, my name is Wendy Johnson, Deputy Director and General Counsel for the Oregon Law Commission. Just to take another 50,000 feet level and actually help Senator Dembo out since he didn't hear these two bills last session. Last session, the Law Commission introduced or had requested Senate Bill 622 and 623. 622 was a juvenile records bill and 623 was an adoption records bill. Both projects came at the request of the Judicial Department because the courts are moving to electronic records and it wasn't clear in existing law who was supposed to get what records when, and so it was even more complicated when we added an electronic level of who was to get what record in a file and when. And so the bill that you have before you today and the Dash 2 amendments are tweaks to those big complicated bills, basically. The Law Commission didn't have the time really to do a quick fix-it bill this session and do a work group, but we were asked to bring our work group to assist with this cleanup bill, and both members from the adoption work group and the juvenile records group have weighed in and have supported these provisions that you're asked to look at today. It doesn't come with the commission recommendation because we were not able to do that whole process, but it does come with the work group endorsement. So I'll just speak to specifically the Dash 2 amendments, which is affixed to the adoption bill. As the court's judicial department was working to implement the adoption bill, Senate Bill 623, and prepare training materials and forms, it was noticed that the courts were about to apply in one provision in a way that the work group didn't expect. And so we're asking to fix that issue. You'll see in the Dash 2 amendments that it's a request to amend ORS 109.319, and that's the statute that's new law that outlines who's to get what part of an adoption record. The first sub 1 of that section just says the court has to keep a record. Sub 2 says that that record will be sealed. And then sub 3 says that puts out the list of prior to the adoptee, the minor, becoming 18, who's to get the record. And then sub 4 is who's to get that record after the minor is 18. And that would include the minor. The law now will provide that a minor who was an adoptee upon turning 18 will be able to get access to their adoption records with the exception of the home study. It also makes it clear that adoptive parents will be able to always have access, the courts will always have access, DHS will have access, and the attorneys of the adoptive parents will have access. This is important because the prior law before last session said they have a court order every time to access the adoption record. So the part that had the glitch in it is in sub 5, and that is for post age 18, the birth parents, who we're generally talking about, those who consented to the adoption. It wasn't clear enough in our bill last session of what records those people were to get. The work group did make a recommendation, and the legislature passed it unanimously to make it clear that they will get records, but they do need to do a motion, the birth parents, and there are three things that should be excluded that are the most sensitive to a case: medical history, the home study, and the adoption report. But we referenced a statute that had this new material segregated and just represents statute generally and didn't list it all out, and so it wasn't clear. So what you see in the Dash 2s is just a listing out of what was in that statute, but not as broad, because it even would include every name of the players, and that was intended to be given. So now, with this amendment, there wouldn't be a redaction required for everything. It just would be those three documents that would be excluded, and Social Security numbers, phone numbers, and addresses. But otherwise, it would be provided. The list is duplicated twice because there is a distinction between regular private adoptions and DHS adoptions, and DHS adoptions have more protections because those are coming out of a dependency case, and in those cases, the birth parents will get adoption records upon motion, but they will not have any identifying information because of there's an abuse situation going on of why those kids were in the adoption. So we've just spelled it out so the courts and the clerks know what documents can be given, but it's not a policy change, and it reflects what the work group had intended. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right. Questions for anyone on the panel? I don't see any. So I think y'all did a very good job in explaining what we're trying to do and making some fixes. So thank you very much. Let me ask, because I have not, is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 1536? Not seeing anyone raising their hand or running to the podium? I assume not. So I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on 1536. Bill, can you give us a status as to looks like something coming
committee,
in here?
Committee, we still do not have the fiscal impact.
Okay.
He's not bringing it to the best of my knowledge. You could adopt the Dash 2 amendments if you so choose, and then the only thing we'd have to do is move the bill once we have the fiscal.
Is there any benefit from moving the Dash 2s into the bill just to for moving paperwork?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
All right, let's go ahead and do that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So I'm going to go ahead and open up a work session for the purpose on 1536 for the purpose of adopting the Dash 2s. As I just heard, it appears that that will help streamline getting the paperwork here regarding that particular amendment.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Senator Close?
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 1536.
Senator Close moves the Dash 2 amendments into Senate Bill 1536. Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. And with that, I'm going to go ahead and close the work session on 1536. And then we're going to go to our last bill that we have scheduled for today, which is will be a public hearing on SJR 203.
Members of the committee, this bill comes from you. Allows judges to teach at the Oregon public universities without violating the Oregon Constitution. Allows a judge to be a member of the Oregon National Guard. Clarifies that an employee of a public school or university can still be a member of the legislature. Rescinds SJR 34 of the 2013 session. You may remember that bill from the last time. And what happened is we were addressing that issue as it relates to judges in the National Guard. We then changed the underlying structure and how we approach how we govern the governance for colleges and universities, so that the constitutional provision was didn't sit in all. The SJR 34 wouldn't have hit the target it was intended to hit.
All right. So clarification is basically when we passed what was SJR 34, we were still working on the premise of how we identify the Board of Higher Ed as being the umbrella over the universities, and now because we're going through this new model that's more of a public-private corporation, if I'm not mistaken, or...
It's Dembro's fault, by the way. So it's
no, he actually called us on this when it was in the House side.
Yes,
and we said,
that.
Oh, no, it's fine. Unfortunately, it wasn't. So, Senator Dembro, did you want to make another comment regarding this particular issue as to the authority or jurisdiction over the higher ed institutions?
No, Mr. Chair, I think that, as the administrator presented it, we're in different times now. It's a different governance structure. The State Board of Higher Ed does not employ the faculty. They're now, many cases, employed by the boards of the universities, or they will be as of this July 1st. And so my sense is that this change reflects that.
Right. So that's why it's here, for the, as we're having this kind of like public hearing, which is really more of a work session type of stuff, I guess what I would just say, for the record, Floyd Przanski, State Senator, District 4, and the reason we wanted to bring this forward was because it did come to our attention that what we have sent to the voters that would be voted on in this November would not be addressing the issue that we've been attempting to address for the past three, if not four, sessions, that would in fact allow sitting judges to be able to be compensated for their work at a public law school, which is we only have one in the state. They can in fact be compensated at the two private schools, so this will give some type of parity. And also the issue regarding judges who serve in the military department as a reserve as to their issues of being in the judicial branch and then also being potentially in the executive branch for the military service, just like if they're teaching at a law school. or the University of Oregon's law school, which is the public law school.
Let's go into work session and move this thing.
All right. So we close the... I had to go through the formality.
You
was
did.
There anyone else who wants to give testimony on SJR 203? That's what I needed to do.
Yes.
There is none. So now we're open up a work session on SJR 203. Senator Close?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Joint Resolution 203 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Senator Close moves Senate Joint Resolution 203 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Additional discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And the chair will carry this one to the floor. And with that, that concludes our work today. I do want to go over a couple of housekeeping. Tomorrow we do have Senate Bill 1551 that will be held for public hearing only. There will not be a work session scheduled for that. The purpose and intent for not having a work session tomorrow is to allow for as much testimony, public hearing testimony, we can get in. There will be some invited testimony that will also be part of tomorrow's proceedings. One of the things I would like to request members to consider, if your schedules will permit, we are scheduled to meet now from 8 to 10. I am planning as a chair to sit through at least till 10:30. We will be on the floor at 11, and so what my goal here is to allow for additional testimony outside of the prescribed time. Now, I understand that everyone has schedules and they're busy. If you are not able to stay the full length of the time, that will be understood, and you will be excused from staying the for the duration. But my goal is to stay till 10:30, possibly a few minutes later, just to close whatever panels we may have, knowing that we are scheduled to be on the floor at 11, unless there's a change in that, which I'm going to go find out if there will be. The other thing is that our room assignment for tomorrow will be down in at the basement level, room 50, as compared to here. We do expect that we will have a very large crowd, as we have in the past on this topic, such as reflected in 2013 with Senate Bill 700. So with that, any questions? All right, thank you very much. And we'll be starting as promptly as we can to 8 o'clock. There is one thing I will state is that we are going to have the governor come in. His time frame is going to cause us to maybe start the actual public hearings. That's one of the invited panels. Mm-hmm. And we may have to kind of go back and forth just to accommodate his schedule as well.
We usually do, don't we?
We do.
Yes.
All right. If there's not any other work for the committee, we'll be adjourned until tomorrow, room 50 at 8 o'clock, 8 in the morning.